Today's podcast is brought to you by Tetra Hearing. Tetra Hearing isn't just hearing protection, it's hearing perfection.
All right. So we get to have some fun today, huh?
Which camera's on me? I just want
to They're all on you, John. They're all on you. What the? We don't have any on us today.
All lights on John.
These guys better be on camera.
Well, guys, if you haven't noticed, we're here with John Carlson, our now current president, but soon to be retired president this August. And we're here talking to him, talking about his 14 years at the organization, talking about the organization, what we've been able to accomplish. I've got Jake Messerly, our new CEO, here next to me. So we're just going to dive into this, have some fun, and learn some more about Mr. Carlson than we don't know.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. Talking to you guys to do this, I'm excited about talking about things. I think one of the first things I'd like to say to folks out there is that I feel super fortunate to have had a career like this, to be in a career where my passion of hunting and natural resources, you know, I got to focus on helping conserve, protect, and of course, trying my whole career to get better opportunities for hunters across the board, you know. And I've had a lot of people come up to me and they're like, hey, man, how do you get a job like that? You know, dude, I'm going to give up, you know, working at the grocery store. I'd like to work, you know, for you. And like, you know, it's a lot of people don't realize it's very tough. All of us in this career have had education through colleges, and then the odds of getting into the career are very tough because there's just not that many jobs. And so the competition for those jobs is tough. And to me, it's kind of cool because the passion of everybody you work with is top-notch. Our whole team, top-notch passion. Our supporters, top-notch passion. It's great. It's great. Yeah. A lot of laughs along the line, too. I can see by the smirk on your face we're going to be getting into some of that.
We try to have fun. We don't take ourselves too seriously, but, you know, I think we take our jobs pretty seriously. But you said something there that spurred, I think, I don't know how many times you guys have heard this, but I'll be talking to somebody about the organization and talking to them about how this is my job. And they're like, this is what you do all the time? Like they have no understanding, I guess maybe the organization, or that we have 50 employees and that, you know, we're a big company, $22 million company. And so it always amazes me that the people – and that's, I don't know if that's happened to you, John. Like
recently at one of our dinners, one of our big donors, his wife said to me, So what do you really do? I mean, what do you do?
We've been asking that question for a long time. Yeah.
But she was like, What's your real job? This is a volunteer gig, right? And I'm like, well, no, we have 50 employees you know, several million-dollar budget. And a lot of folks just assume that nonprofits are all volunteer organizations. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, we have to play by the same rules as all other businesses, and we have to, you know, if you're gonna be making a difference in this world, you know, your operation has to have scale, and you have to have the money to keep the lights on. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't realize that. They just think it's a volunteer organization, and we're all kind of goofing off. Farthest thing from the truth.
Yeah. So I'm going to take you back to 14 years plus whenever you first heard about this job. And I've heard the story before, you know. I mean, I know, you work for the state. Let's just say that, you know, work for the state's a pretty cush job and a lot of benefits. You can tell a little bit about how that happened, because I know that's an interesting how you kind of got interested in. And
so where's that similar, whiskey at?
it's kind of similar to me. When I first joined the organization, I didn't look at it the first couple times that it came in my mind to come work here. So you can tell that story, but also I want to hear about maybe some of your biggest concerns with jumping and coming over.
Oh, sure. Well, I will say, working for the state, there's a lot of people who think state workers are lazy bums, and that they, you know, there's the old story I heard of. There was a crew up out of Reading of Caltrans guys who they get to their work site right out of Redding off of Highway 299 and they realize they have forgotten their shovels. And they get on the radio and they're calling back to headquarters, you know, we don't have our shovels, you know, what are we going to do? And the boss, kind of a smart ass, says, well, I'll get some shovels up. And in the meantime, just lean on each other and just hang out. <you know? laughs> But I will say at Fish and Game, if it's same with CWA, the folks that are passionate about natural resources and passionate about hunting and, you know, the biologists, the folks that run the wildlife areas, they work their butts off. And, you know, getting those jobs is very tough also, very competitive. Sure. It's not easy getting in there. And if you've got the passion for our natural resources and our hunting populations, you're gonna be working your butt off. That's just how it is. Leaving that, yeah, I've said this a million times, Chad Santier, who's one of our top habitat folks in CWA for well over 20 years now, he was a seasonal aide for me about 35 years ago at Fish and Game. And that's where I first met him. He was entering deer tags, and he was in college. And anybody that knows Chad now, back when he was in college and he was 19 years old, he was a hot mess. He was a rowdy kid and a lot of fun, but, you know, he's a 19-year-old in college. We've been friends ever since. And he, in 2010, called me up and said, you know, Bob McLandris is retiring. You should come on over. And when he first called me, you know, I'm like, Chad, come on. I'm the executive director of the Fish and Game Commission. I'm entrenched at the state. I've got 21 years in. Walk away, like you said, there are benefits. The state had, at that time, good benefits. And I said no to Chad. Well, he kept calling. He called me at least four times over the next couple months. And then the waterfowl biologist for the state at the time, Dan Perigary, said, did you see that job announcement? And I hadn't looked at it. And he put it in front of me, and I started looking, and I thought, oh, man. It would be a stretch, you know, for my family and from a financial perspective to make the move, but it sure sounded enticing because leaving at the commission, we were focusing on like 350 different regulations from fishing permits for commercial salmon guys all the way down to the smallest endangered species. And everything we did, we got sued. There was a lawyer for every interest group out there on our butts, the pressure, it was not fun. It was not fun. And the reason I took that commission job was really to focus on protecting hunting in California. That was my personal goal, but with it came a lot of other stuff. So as I got to know CWA better as far as what they were asking for that position and what the compensation would be and how it might work, you know, kind of the rest is history. We were able to make it work and I never looked back at the state. After I left, 3 years later, a lawsuit that had been quietly pending for many, many years gave a 40% raise to all the supervisors in Fish and Game. I didn't even know that was coming. So I would have, if I had stayed, it would have been unbelievable. I mean, it was unbelievable for those folks. But I'm happy where I'm at, happy where I stayed, and I got to still stay connected to all my friends at Fish and Game because for us to do what we do, we have to work with them. And it was great. But it's all Chad's fault. It's all Chad's fault. So, was there something else in that question you, my concerns? I think I kind of covered the concerns. There's people out there, including some of our board members, who say taking that leap from a state job that I had 21 years in, I was fully vested. The only way you're going to get fired from the state after 21 years is if you break a law. I mean, you have to really do something stupid to get fired from the state then to go to a nonprofit where, you know, you could, you know, if there's an economic downturn. And remember, 08 and 09 were some of our worst economic years in decades. So people thought, there were a lot of people who thought I was being kind of reckless and crazy doing what I did.
Kind of like you drive?
Ha! Jake thinks I drive perfectly.
I'm still trying to overcome my car sickness from yesterday.
And we hardly drove at all yesterday. But yeah, there was someone from another conservation organization who, two people from different conservation organizations thought I was insane. And they thought our board was very dangerous at that time, very dangerous towards employees. But, you know, just got to work it through.
So looking back, kind of fast forwarding now, so kind of give a little historical, you know, at that time, California waterfowl, we had just really dove into a lot of the education programs at some of the properties, and then we're in the process of acquiring our first properties through the Bechtel, Mr. Bechtel, and that just generous gift that he gave us. How do you look back at the organization, those times, and where we've been, where we were, and then where now we're at today, and maybe touch on some of the biggest accomplishments for the organization over the last 14 years?
I think, you know, early on, we were, a lot of folks don't realize our headquarters was off of Northgate Boulevard in Sacramento. We were renting a small, funky office. It was kind of like a maze. You know, you'd walk in there, and I got lost when I used to visit that office in the hallways. And, you know, there were a lot. You look back, and we had so much going on then, right, with trying to get our own building, which was no easy task, because we had a lot of requirements, and of course, we didn't have a ton of money in the bank for that. And then Mr. Bechtel and his foundation working with us to give us thousands of acres of land. There were a lot of things going on, and it was a cool ride at the time. But you look back, and it all happened in a fairly short period of time. And I look back at us getting this office here in Roseville as a huge accomplishment for the organization. And it was really cool how our volunteers banded together and worked with us to raise the money to pay the building off within the first year that we owned it, right? And the tenant improvements and have some money left over. That really was probably the earliest moment that I realized we had some serious supporters who loved our mission and loved our energy and loved what we were doing. Because that really, you know, there were people out there who, I remember when we first said we were going to move, there were some folks said, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you just rent? Why would you put money into, you know, and I thought it was always money into an investment. It was an investment in our future. This building over the last 12 years has been an anchor point for us, right? We haven't had to pay rent in 12 years. Plus, I know it's gone up amazing in value. We're in a great part of, you know, California. We're centrally located for our membership. But there were some naysayers back then, but we got past it all. We got past it. And then, of course, right at the same time, you know, Jake was heavily involved with the Bechtels and getting that land deal together and their generosity. When first meeting with Steve Bechtel, and he was kind of pitching it, and he said he was looking for a nonprofit. He hadn't decided on us yet. I think he was kind of kicking around a couple of national nonprofits as possibilities. But we won him over on our passion and what we would deliver for those properties, right? Manage them in for perpetuity for waterfowl and wetlands, and giving access to the public for the hunting, for the kids' camps. He bought into it all, and I can honestly say that we did not fail to deliver on any of those things we said. We're continuing to deliver on all of them, and we've built quite a program with that, those lands. 5,500 acres. I mean, who would have thought? Mm-hmm. Who would have thought? And we've got more acres. Jake and I have been meeting with folks lately who, you know, they see what we do with the land, and there's possibilities of other donations of wetlands coming to us. So it's all exciting. It's kind of all, you know, the momentum is, to me, for our organization is great. And the momentum is, you know, momentum comes from, I remember hard luck, there's a saying, hard luck is the residue of, good luck is the residue of hard work. And I think our organization has kind of epitomized that. We work hard, and we've had some great luck with donations and support. I could keep monologuing, but you better ask me the question.
I know Jake's got one for you.
What's that? I don't know. Well, I guess we all enjoy working here. We've had a good time together over 14 years, sometimes maybe too good of a time. I'm sure the listeners want to know what are some of the reasons that you're retiring, you're moving on, and what are you going to do next?
Sure. I have had these discussions with Jake and my spouse. You know, I do have mental anguish on retiring, and this is something that, you know, from the standpoint that I've been working since I was 11 years old. I'm sorry, 15 years old. 15 years old. I got $1 an hour bussing tables at an Italian pizza place back in Chicago, and really have not had a break since then. And, you know, part-time jobs through school and the whole nine yards. So it is, the unknown is there's some mental anguish on how that's gonna feel and how I'm gonna react to it. I have friends who have retired, several friends younger than me who have retired from state and federal jobs, Fish and Wildlife Service, Fish and Game, who just flipped a switch and walked away. I mean, flipped a switch, and the next day they never looked back and never were in touch with the department again. I'm not wired that way, you know. I want to help. I want to volunteer. I want to help out, you know, moving forward. I'm going to finally get my Hunter Ed instructor certificate. And because I like working with kids. I am a coach on a youth trap shooting team, and I love seeing kids learn about, you know, firearm safety, the outdoors, and those things. But I guess getting back to the reason I'm retiring, you know, my wife retired last year. Got a lot of travel plans. I'm no spring chicken. I'm 64 and a half now. And I just, I know that we're handing it off, or I'm handing it off. I mean, Jake's got a lot of more energy than I do, and that's a great thing for the organization. So I'm not ruling out anything in the future as far as maybe helping out some organizations part-time, you know, and it's definitely staying involved. I did get, which is really nice, and I'm excited about it. I was accepted at the National Conservation Leadership Institute as a volunteer peer coach for their upcoming cohort, which that's kind of a neat honor to be able to help coach folks from across the country who are going to be going through this institute. Conservation leaders from all walks of the country, state agencies, federal agencies, nonprofits. So I'm looking forward to still keeping my nose in the game. Mm-hmm. I'm not just going to flip a switch like some folks do.
Yeah, but I got to imagine that, you know, thinking back to the 14 years and the travel and the late nights and how many events you go to, I got to think that Michelle is pretty happy that Thursday, Friday, Saturday night are going to be set aside for her and the kids, and just that you're not in name the city all over the town, all over the state. But I mean,
yeah, I mean, there was definitely, and you know, you look back and you think about the sacrifices your families have made, and you guys have the same thing. You guys travel. You know that in this world, if you want to, in the nonprofit world, and in getting the word out to our supporters in person, it's going to be evenings and weekends. There's no way around that, right? And I'll never forget, like, the first 6 months that I was on the job, I was at our dinner in Colusa. So I started in July of 2010. Later that winter, I was there in Colusa, and I brought Zachary, my son, who at the time was probably 8 years old. And Bob McLandris, my predecessor, our former president, and his wife were there. So we sat with them, and it was nice. And then I went out and worked the crowd. While I was gone, Bob told me later, he said, Zachary said that you're gone from home too much and they miss you. And it really hit me hard. I mean, it was like, God, dang, you know, didn't realize that a little kid would think that. So I tried to balance things out, and I was fortunate that he was interested in going to a lot of events. He used to help volunteer and help, you know, the ticket girls. And so that helped with that part of the family. But, yeah, moving forward, it will be nice not to have to travel that much, for sure. And you know, we all make sacrifices in these jobs.
I was just going to say, and Zach's always welcome to come back, but, John, you got to buy a ticket.
Yeah. Yeah, he'd love that.
So you talked a little bit about Jake. You know, he's been in the role as CEO now since April 1st. And
April 1st, it's a funny day, huh?
Yeah. So what advice do you have for him?
You know, Jake has been my right-hand guy for 6 years as the COO, and we've worked together on a lot of things. And I always joke with Jake about working on a poker face.
Yeah.
You know, when things get kind of rough, you know, on issues, you know, and he'll learn as he's going along, and he knows it already, that, you know, as the leader, you have to have diplomacy. You know, you've got to have patience. You have to have a lot of times, and I've learned this the hard way myself, you have to sit on your anger overnight. You can't zip off an email or a text or a phone call or a confrontation immediately in anger. And in my earlier days in my career, you know, I made some mistakes, big time mistakes. Mm-hmm. And back in the early days of email, you could do a email to all 4,000 employees of Fish and Game. Yeah. And I did a couple that were pretty bad, you know. So those kind of things, you know, you have to have the patience. I do remember a story, and I was thinking this morning. My first supervisor job at Fish and Game, I was in my early 30s. I got lucky. I competed for a supervising biologist. It was unheard of for someone in their early 30s to get those jobs. But it was a job that supervised the non-game bird and mammal shop, which was all the non-game endangered species. Think of bald eagles, peregrine falcons, you know, some of our endangered mammals, kit foxes. It was a very highly controversial job, and I competed and got it, and all my employees, the 7 biologists, were experts in their fields. They were all older than me, and they all, you know, looked at me like, who's this snot-nosed whippersnapper? Very stressful. The director at the time, the chief deputy, had to approve all supervisor-level positions, had to meet with you personally and approve it, and he gave me some advice. He was a high-end attorney who was politically appointed at the time. He was a hardcore guy. But he looked at me, he was Carlson, and if I didn't pass the sniff test with him, I was going to be out. It was just me and him. And he said, I want you to remember these initials. ABCBD. So I'm on the edge of my chair, you know. He says it stands for always consult before deciding. And at that time, we were having some lawsuits on endangered species that were unbelievable. And if I talked to the media and said something without consulting, you know, it would have been catastrophic for my career. But I took those words, and I still use them to this day. When, you know, we have a lot of controversial things come our way, you know, policy issues, legal issues, controversies. I'm always talking to my board chair. I've had 8 board chairs now over my career. They serve 2-year careers or two-year appointments. And, of course, work with our management team, work with our supporters. You know, you'll find, and Jake already has, supporters that will be kind of become friends and mentors or not. Maybe you can go to them for counsel, you know, because they love the organization. You get those relationships going, and you consult with folks before you make these big decisions. Because if you make a big decision in a vacuum and you're risking alienating folks at the high levels or even everybody, It's just a bad move. This looks bad for leaders to be doing that. And I'm not making any political comments here. That's, you know, kind of nutshell advice. I mean, Jake's a great guy. Jake's, you know, and he didn't pay me to say that.
But I was going to say, you slipping your money in at the table or what?
No. You don't get to, you know, a lot of people didn't realize that our board had 100 applications to look at before they and interview people before they decided on Jake. And, you know, I had to compete with a ton of people back in 2010. This organization is a popular organization. A lot of people would love to be the CEO of this organization. And you don't get through all that vetting without having the chops to deal with people and to get along with people, you know. Make the hard decisions, but know that diplomacy is important.
Poker face.
He's still working on it.
Yeah, I can relate. But I think just the folks that don't know Jake very well, I mean, you know where you stand, you know, with everything. I think a positive quality in Jake is that, you know, he's not afraid to tell you where to be or where he thinks, you know, a decision on a matter is, which I think is a good characteristic for
he's never held back on me, no matter that I'm his boss. That doesn't matter. Yeah. No.
Yeah. But so.
What do we call it? Crucial conversation?
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Courageous conversation.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Crucial, courageous.
You still got a dent in your bumper from that.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
I didn't hear about that one.
Yeah. We've had some, you know, when you. Oh, never mind.
So let's list a little less serious stuff. So I don't know if you've thought about this, and maybe you can come up with the – you don't need to name names. Is there a funny story with the member, with a donor, with a board member that you don't have to say, but, you know, that sticks in your mind, that's something that you – at the time when it happened, and you can think back and
– Naming names is the fun part.
Well, you can name names.
No, but I think some of the – one of the things that struck me the most, and I actually wrote that in my upcoming, you know, final magazine column, like one of the first wealthy supporter duck clubs that I went to, you know, and you're always in awe. I've been a public duck hunter my whole life, and when I got this job, I was getting invitations to, you know, to high-end clubs, but the one of them had a shellacked quote above the kitchen door in the club that said, "You can tell a duck hunter, but not much." And that just hit me so hard. And it's true. I mean, it is so, you think of all of our hunters and all of our members and their attitudes and their convictions or their, you know, this is the way it's gotta be. It's a stubborn lot. There's no doubt about it, you know. But yeah, I think, you know, going out in the blinds with folks, you see a whole different person. And I won't mention names on a couple of these, but I think one of the most memorable times, I was in a blind with a legislator, and I'm not mentioning names, and this person could not hit a duck that morning. I mean, we had birds, and we were on a pretty good piece of private ground with a lot of birds. And we had a lot of birds coming in at 20 yards, you know, feet down. And they were missing everything. And it got so bad that the legislator started kind of hyperventilating, getting upset with himself. And really, you know, how you start questioning yourself when you miss and you really start to get upset. And next thing you know, you're missing worse and worse because your head's so screwed up. And I had to calm him down. I'm like, man, you know, just settle down. Don't even think about it. Just snap shoot the next, you know. And he never really got on track that morning. So we were done. Well, I remember seeing him at the legislature then, you know, in his full suit and tie about a year later. And he's like, God, that was – he still remembered that. It was like, he's like, dude, don't hold it against me. You know, don't – that's not how I always am. And but it was it was amazing. And to me, the other thing that always strikes me is I'm with folks at their clubs, and they act like if I don't have a good hunt, I'm going to be upset, or I'm going to hold it against them, or I'm going to be, angry. And it's the furthest thing from the truth. I feel humbled and honored anytime I get an invitation. And to be honest, it's the people interactions, right? It's the fun at dinner the night before. It's the fun talking in the blind, having a good time. If somebody misses you, we give each other a hard time. But if the duck hunting's not great that morning, that's hunting. We still had a great interaction. And I've actually had guys tell me, I didn't invite you because the hunting wasn't good. You know, I'm like, that's bullshit. Yep. Come on, man.
Yeah.
I just want to check out your club. I want to, break bread with you and have a great time.
Yeah.
Some of our most powerful members, business-wise, over the years, I've learned that, and they had their own clubs, they would use those duck hunting interactions with business partners to kind of, calm things down and be able to get to know people. It's a great, I've hunted with senators, state senators, congressmen, decision makers for organizations. It's a common denominator. It brings, unless the person's a real royal jerk, 99% of the people, it's just a great way to communicate with everybody, right?
Yeah.
And have fun. So then you'll see these folks fall in the water, right? You'll see them fall down. You'll see them get their waders full of water. You'll see them trip. That's just the way it is. Yeah. They get embarrassed, but I'm like, dude, don't worry. I mean, think about how many times we've all fallen.
Right.
And I know some of our workers, I've seen them go in over their head when they were told, don't walk over there.
Oh. Mark Hanley.
See, I wasn't going to name names.
Yeah. I've been in that boat. No, you mentioned.
Yeah, and were you stuck in the mud one time?
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Davey. You mentioned missing. I always amazed me about duck hunting is that, to me, missing is part of the game, and it makes it more fun. I look at somebody that goes out in the marsh.
You hit everything all the time.
Somebody comes in and says, I shot 7 times, got 7 ducks. Yeah. I'm like, well, what fun is that?
Yeah.
Great, you've practiced your – but to me, it's that laugh in the duck blind because you can't – if you can't laugh at yourself when you miss – you're in the wrong place because
you're too uptight.
Yeah, it's not about. I think all of us as a hunter go through a different stage in where you're at with hunting. When you're young and you start out, you just want to go out there and shoot as many times as you can and honestly kill as much as you can. And then some of us grow out of that and move on to I think the stage of some. I said some, but I think in for whatever reason, some people stay in there, that's fine. But I think hunting to me is just the time in the blind, like you said. It was a lot more fun back when cell phones weren't around and you actually got away from your cell phone, but it's still nice to be in there. And if you don't shoot a duck, it's still a great day. And I think that's the part about what we get to engage with and directly reflects upon our programs and how what we try to do to get people into hunting and protect wildlife and with our conservation efforts. It's just, I don't know, for me, that's what puts a sparkle in my eye is those times, So
some of my memories also on, with our youth camps, for many, many years, I would plan, I'd get the schedule from Jeff, and I would plan to go to the graduation afternoon, when the kids were done with their camp and the parents and the grandparents were coming to pick them up and there'd be a barbecue and we'd give some awards to the kids for, the best duck caller at the end or best learner or best campmate. It was just a great experience because these kids would come out of these camps with, talk about sparkle. Their eyes were just like, boys and girls were just like on fire and the energy. Their parents were like, did you give these kids a ton of sugar just now? What happened? Because they were – and they would want to talk about their experiences and about the, the shooting they did at the camp and the learning and the duck call learning. And you could just see that they're never going to forget that, never forget it.
Yeah.
And the parents and the grandparents could see there was a difference in their child after that camp. And I can't say enough about – our kids' camps and how that goes. And both of my kids have gone through them. And my oldest Zach when he was 10 and he went through a camp, and I driving him back the whole way, he was just yammering about the regulations. I mean, yammering. I'm like, what you think I'm breaking regulations?
Come say. On.
Yeah, but he was just going off about, did you know this and that? I'm like, oh, God, what have I done? Yeah. Yeah. It's great.
So speaking of that, just something, and since you are outgoing, I'm going to put you on the spot.
You've never done that before.
No, I think there's so many great things the organization does in different programs. What's your favorite?
Yeah. So this is the diplomatic side.
Diplomatic. We don't have to do that anymore.
I know that I drove you guys crazy over the years, and at the department crazy sometimes when bosses, when they say prioritize. Well, I'd have like five top priorities. You know, it's hard to
just five.
You know, but I mean, at the like with us, like legislation, yeah. Right? The legislation, sure. our wetlands program, our wood duck program. You know, you start looking at these. To me, they're all top priorities. It's hard to put one above the other. But I do have to say that, you know, going on our lobby days, I really, really, really enjoyed those, because especially when we would bring some of our membership and their children would start talking to these old hard case legislators that don't really have open minds, right? And you're in their office and you've got, you know, a young girl who's maybe 13 or 14 who starts talking about her memories of the sunrise coming up in the duck blind and talking about everything going on. Now, if I told that story, the legislator would blow it off. But they're watching these kids, and you could see them listening, and you could see their acceptance of what we're passionate about starting to happen. I love that. I love that. And probably the funniest thing at those lobby meetings, we were in a legislator's office. And a week later, and we took pictures in that office, and we put pictures on our website of our volunteers that went on the lobby day, some of our membership, and that young woman and me outside the door of that legislator's office with the name. A week later, the FBI raided that office, and that guy went to prison for really bad stuff. But I was like, oh, my God.
I remember that.
And then I would joke with people and say, well, when we were in there and there were bowls of money, I didn't think anything about it. I don't know, you know. But anyway, you know, those lobby days to me is just an exciting way to get our message across to people that don't know anything about hunting. It's always been the big battle, right? You've got like 80% of the population that really, they don't care about hunting and they don't know much about it. And you've got your fringe that hate it, and then you've got your fringe that love it. But, you know, we've always said to move the needle, we've got to get that 80% or more, the regular people, just to at least accept it. Mm-hmm. We're not asking them all to hunt, but we want them to accept it. And the same thing with the legislators. I've always been proud that CWA can enter into any side of the aisle, into those offices, because there are some lobbyists out there who are so hardcore in their position that they cannot go across the aisle. They were not welcome to those other offices. And with us, they see that we are walking the talk. When they find out that, hey, yeah, we're a hunting organization, but guess what? We restore 20,000 acres of wetlands a year on the ground. We've got this many youth camps. You know, we have this many wood duck boxes that, you know, they start hearing that and they're like, holy cow, you guys are really unusual. And, oh, we partner with Audubon on these things. Next thing you know, we can get into anybody's office. And I love that about CWA. I mean, I love it. So that's one of the tops for sure. The veterans program, going to those veterans. I've been to veterans lunches after the hunts. When my kids were little, we were at a grizzly ranch. This veteran was pulling off his waders. He had two titanium legs. Dude, if that doesn't get you, what does? And he was so happy about what we did. So, no, we got some great stuff going on, no doubt about it. It's just the battle is always getting more people to know about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's always the battle. Get the scale going, get the capacity.
Was there, kind of going back a little bit, when you switched to, when you left Department of Fish and Game and you took the job, at what point during that first year, month, week, did you, if you had any doubts about changing jobs, did you go, wow, I did the right thing?
Oh, I thought you were going to say, wow, I was scared.
No, but if you had, I mean, I got to assume that you said it was a hard decision.
Yeah.
You had a great job career with fishing game. And then at what point did you just say, wow, I am so happy I made this move?
You know, I'll never forget my first day in the office. You guys gathered all the employees on July 8th, 2010, and I'm all in the conference room to meet me. And I walk in, and there was this loudmouth, little gray-haired guy in the back.
Oh, jeez.
He's like, do you like ribs? And I'm like, Tim DeVanis. And that weekend, they were having the rib feed over in Santa Rosa. Yeah. And he hauled my ass over there to meet all the volunteers out there. It was great. It was great. But it wasn't long. I want to say 2-3 months into the job that I had my annual doctor checkup. My blood pressure had gone down 20 points. And that's when I knew, because you could focus, you know, I could focus on the things I loved. I loved hunting. I loved, you know, youth camps. I loved getting the message out, right? I hadn't realized that over at the department with all the bullshit attorneys and all this, we were getting sued no matter what we did at the commission. No matter what you did, somebody was suing you. I didn't realize how that was, you know, and at that time I was 50, how it was weighing me down. You just don't realize it's kind of insidious, you know, it slowly builds up. So after a couple of months with CWA, it was, you know, now it didn't take long for CWA to start grinding me down. Nah. But, going to our events, going, the excitement of getting land, right? The college camp was already set up the year before I started. Going to that for the first time was a real eye-opener about, I didn't realize, I mean, I kind of knew, but I didn't realize how the swing in the wildlife programs, there were so few people who had ever been exposed to hunting in those wildlife programs. So the idea of the college camp was just awesome and so needed. So, did that answer your question?
Well, you stayed, so I imagine.
It was pretty quick. Well, it was pretty quick, you know, and as you get going and you get to know the hardest part, like I was telling Jake, the mental anguish, kind of the hardest part is over 14 years, I'll call them friendships with a ton of our supporters, a ton, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, staff and board members. So you look at, I mean, that's tough to walk away. Get your attention. But, you know, you've built those things over time, and my phone number is not changing. My cell number is, that was the cell number the department gave me in, when did we first start carrying those big bulky cell phones? Probably in the, around 95, 96 maybe. Then they gave me a BlackBerry. So, but that number, when I left the department, I had to negotiate with the department to keep that phone number. And I just had to switch it over to my own, you know, account, and it'll be with me forever. So I'll still get some, there's some people who I don't want to call me, but, you know, what can you do?
I don't think those connections are going away, John.
I know. It's just how you keep them, you know.
Yeah. I could tell that retirement, I mean, that's a big transition for anybody. And you've used the word mental anguish. It's a big change for the family, for you, for CWA, for our staff, our volunteers. But I think you're handling it well. And I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, how things go in the next couple months. You're going to have some nice vacations, some time off.
Yep.
Reset, go to NCLI. Do some coaching.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I'm sure we'll still be working on stuff together.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I've been telling Jake, you know, I have a hard time, like all of our fall events are on my calendar, right? And I have people, in fact, this morning I got an email from one of our staff saying, well, we've got these dates in September. I'm like, it's hard for me to say, well,
Sell tickets.
Yeah, you said you buy tickets.
No. I'm talking about meetings with officials on, say, easements or something, things going on. But, yeah, the events for sure. But then there's other things that, you know, where I might have a relationship with somebody. But, yeah, I'm always a phone call away, and I'm more than happy to talk with people.
And I'm sure that especially if it's a Wednesday, Saturday, Sunday from October 26th through January 31st, you're available.
Exactly. Well, especially the second.
I thought you were just going to lift off the pheasant season.
Exactly. I was going to say except for November 10th through the
second Saturday of November is a holy day for me, you know, the start of pheasant season. So, but yeah, it will be interesting for sure. But then there will be, like I say, I've never had that freedom. So I'll be able to wake up in the morning and say, you know, what issues are bothering me, or what am I losing sleep over? And a lot of that's happened over the years. You know, we've got a lot of things that nothing's easy with CWA. We've got, you know, we have to work hard for everything we get, whether it's the state or federal grant or working with donors. Got to keep them happy. So those things will keep you up at night. You guys know that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when I don't have to worry about that.
Well, I'm sure what, four weeks in Europe will help?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
I think they drink a lot of wine over there.
Yeah. There you go. Well, I got a question for both of you. So we haven't heard a lot from Jake today, and we'll start with Jake. So what are the biggest challenges you think facing? And this is I want to get it back to John as well, and I think that he has spoken to it a little bit with the organization and what we do. But, you know, looking forward, what are our biggest challenges as an organization, as a hunting group in California?
There's so many. There's so many challenges. The biggest ones. We've been talking a lot about, we're in the process of, you know, trying to hire a director of marketing and communications, and the word market comes up, and you look at all the efforts across the country on the whole R3 effort, recruit, retain, reintroduce hunters. It's because there's a declining, I don't know if it's declining number of hunters. And so that market of our core customer is shrinking. And when you're in a business that's shrinking, it creates some significant challenges, funding support, policy support, all of those things. And we are challenged with maintaining a certain level, a baseline level of support to keep operations going, to keep the support for hunting going. And that's tough, especially in a state like California. And there's so many other things for people to do these days. The world's just changed, and it's a different place from when you grew up, John, or me, mm-hmm. or Scott, and even for my kids. I'm dealing with all the travel sports, and mm-hmm. and there are a huge number of distractions or you know, different things for kids to do these days. And hunting is not as widely accepted or part of society as it was. And I think wrestling with all of those changes and you know, NCLI, you know, the National Conservation Leadership Institute, as John knows, talked a lot about relevancy and how does this community stay relevant. And that's a big challenge for us.
Winning hearts and minds, right?
Changing hearts and minds. But – you know, there are a lot of smart people trying to figure out how to deal with the declining number of hunters, fishermen, and that work is very difficult, especially when you also have declining populations of ducks and fish and wildlife and you know, the ability to access and have a quality experience in the field, all of those things are getting harder and harder. So the stressors that that puts on an organization like CWA and the staff that's trying to, you know, maintain a certain baseline operation and being tasked with growing the organization in a declining market, those are hard. Those are hard things to deal with. So I don't know if that answered your question, but it's a multitude of things that create challenges for a group like CWA that we're constantly thinking about and looking for new ways to engage people. Mm-hmm. We met, John and I spent yesterday down in Southern California and talking with folks down there. We had the same conversation. You know, we've got 19,000 members. There's 70,000 duck hunters and more other hunters and other conservation-minded folks in the area that could support CWA, and we need them to. We need them to support CWA and other conservation groups, and we need to figure out what the disconnect is. You know, mm-hmm. What are we doing wrong, or why aren't we connected with these folks? Why aren't they engaged and helping the cause that we believe so strongly about? I mean, for Scott and me to stay working in an organization for over 25 years for Scott and me for 23. I mean, we believe in what this organization does. And I know that, not to speak for Scott, but we want to see the same opportunities that we had, you know, for our kids and their kids. And that vision, it gets a little cloudy sometimes. And you talk about losing sleep at night and, you know, those stressors are real. So I think, you know, there's a lot to unpack there, but significant challenges.
Sure.
Well, one thing that helps me sleep at night, you know, when I was still with the Fish and Game Commission, I would go twice a year to the Association of Western Fish and Wildlife Agencies meeting. This was every state in the West. It's an organization that the Fish and Games would get together a couple times a year and talk about policy, talk about relevance, talk about recruiting more anglers and hunters. And there at this one big group with everybody at the meeting, all the directors, they were talking about, well, if you had less than 4% of your population were hunters, you had no relevance. You were pretty much done. And we in California, of overall hunting license, we've been less than 4% for a while. And I challenged him. I said, that's BS. And I still, to this day, will say that's BS, because we'd love to have 4%, but without it, we still, and I think CWA has been a huge part of this. Our relationships over at the legislature, they know we're hunters. We have relevance. When we walk in the door, we have relevance because we've been working our relationships with legislators and staffers over at the Capitol for the last 40 years. And they understand hunting because of us, at least a relevant amount of those decision makers know us and their staff. And that's the importance of CWA. So to me, yeah, there's a lot of concerns, and I agree with everything Jake said, but I think we're working in the right arenas to help keep us on the relevant scale with the decision makers. You know, if CWA didn't exist in California, and there's no other nonprofit in California that has the relationships we do over it, you know, and so our accomplishments in getting people to understand hunting as helping the whole hunting community, whether you're an elk hunter or a pig hunter or a pheasant hunter, it's helping everybody. And but keeping working on getting better and better ways to get everybody involved is important. But I said I'd throw that plug in for CWA because a lot of people don't realize our relationships are super important. The world is built on relationships, and over at the Capitol, it's for real. And those staffers, they stay for decades. They have a lot of power over mm-hmm. there, a lot of power. Legislators come and go. Those staffers, they don't forget.
Yeah. Yeah, I think just to kind of put the hammer on the head. You know, we've said this for years, and I've always said it, that if hunting goes away in California, we as an organization don't exist, most likely. And that's a scary thought, but that tells you, to me, that tells you that what we do as an organization supports hunting. And we're here to fight for hunting. We're here to create new hunters. We're here to create better habitat, more ducks, help other wildlife. But, you know, just from a whole, it's not that our support comes from hunting, which it does mostly. But, you know, we as an organization, our programs are built around hunting. And so if that goes away in the state, I mean, I point that out, it's different than a lot of other organizations out there that are there. Not that, you know, but it's an important differentiating point between us, and it's important. It's what we've built this organization around. We were started by duck hunters and duck hunting, so we try to support that with everything we do.
Well, I would say early in my career, I have to give a couple shout outs to people who mentored me.
Sure.
Like Ray Lewis, the first year. So Ray had been, and for a lot of CWA members, you know, Ray's been gone now for 13 years, but he was with CWA. He was probably on our board of directors for over 30 years. He was one of the people that really built the modern, or helped influence and build the modern CWA. But he would call me once or twice a week for every year. I mean, day in, day, I mean, week in, week out, with advice on our dinners and our merchandising and just a great, great guy. And when he passed away, it was a loss for us, but he left a legacy, and that's why this building's named after him. To this day, if I'm at a meal for one of our dinners and if something goes wrong, I think, oh God, Ray would be, we'd have to scrape him off the ceiling. He'd be so pissed, you know?
Yeah.
And then Bill Quinn was another, you know, I mean, we've had great board members, but he would call me. We'd talk probably weekly for the whole time that he, you know, was on our board. And so him and I overlapped, I want to say, probably 11 years. You know, our board has been great. Our supporters, our dinner committee chairs, I mean, how many of them, and we become good friends with them over decades. I mean, decades. It is like a big family. There's no doubt about it. And I heard years ago, at a convention for another organization, a volunteer who was getting an award said, hey, listen, I came for the cause, but I stayed for the people. And I mean, that goes deep with us. I mean, we all have connections to the people, all of our supporters, and I can't say enough about that.
I have a funny story about Ray. It kind of goes, it piggybacks. It's a good story though, because I mean, as you loved Ray, I did too. I think he was a great person. He was a great mentor of the organization. I think after he would meet with you, he would come meet with me, and I'd have the pages of yellow paper written down with
his handwritten notes,
with ideas and comments on the last dinner he went to. And I think it was, you know, unfortunately Ray left us 13 years ago, but I think at that time the organization, I think, was really taking what he was preaching and doing it, and we were already putting it into motion because it was, his ideas were good. I mean, he going way back to Bill Quinn, the what they used to call them, the pop-up events where they would do
free-for-alls.
Yep. So everything from but the funny story with Ray is I usually would sit through probably maybe a quarter of all the lists because he just couldn't, he had to go or leave because he had that many things to go over. And the funny thing, not the funny things, but like everything from the size of the shrimp at the Marin dinner to the knives need to be 440 steel or whatever. And so, I look back and I chuckle a little bit about that, but I also respected him enough and understood that what he was mentoring me as well in stuff. And really, where would we be as an organization without what he did for us back in those days? I mean, he put up his own money with product that would just show up at events with our logo on it, and we'd raise funds to support the organization. So,
yeah. There were, you know, in the early days, way before our times, there were times the board had to pass around a hat to make payroll. Yeah. In the '80s, when I was a seasonal in 1987 for CWA, Our office was on Grizzly Island in a tiny couple of rooms. I mean, it was tiny couple of rooms there on Grizzly Island on the state wildlife area. And that's the first time I was ever exposed to Ray. Bob McLandris, who was, you know, the lead on all of the biological work at the time, and I was hired to search for duck nests and banned ducks. He opens up the storage closet, and there's, like, all this booze, like the big bottles of, you know, alcohol. And you look close, and they all had fruit flies floating in throughout the bottles of booze. And there had been this party where they had left the booze open, like, all, you know, for 24 hours, and the fruit flies got in. And Ray Lewis collected it all up, said, we'll put it to good use. And, of course, all of us seasonal workers were, you know, in college. Didn't matter. It's protein, yeah. You know? We didn't. But that was Ray. Ray, you know, he was always thinking about something. No matter what, he was thinking about doing something for us. But, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, back in the wild days, there's a lot of wild CWA stories that, you know, it's kind of the Wild West. Mm-hmm. But the passion was always there, no matter what, you know.
So. Yeah. Well, John, I guess it's your mic to give your parting words to the membership. And I know you said a lot. We've talked a lot about just kind of stories and the organization and your time here. But is there anything else that you want to share?
Well, I hope the membership stays super engaged. These podcasts to me have been a great thing. And I have people approach me and say, yeah, I heard this on the podcast, you know, and in our learning series, I think everything is going in a great direction. And having people engaged is kind of, that's at the end of the day for all of us, right, who work here, that's our measuring stick, right? Having people engaged, and I think we're heading in the right direction. I just hope the membership stays engaged. Hope the membership realizes that everybody that works here is passionate and cares about them and cares about hunting and conservation of waterfowl and wetlands. I mean, nobody here, that's the one thing about a nonprofit. There's no dead wood on the staff. There's no dead wood. Whether, you know, it's the secretary that answers the phone, I've always said we've got to be friendly and we've got to be responsive. And it's paid off. It paid off. So, yeah, I enjoy seeing people in the field. I'll bump in. I've been out, you know, as you mentioned, pheasant hunting. I will cover a lot of miles every year on the public areas. And if I bump into a family that's hunting and the little kid has a banded bird, you know, in the parking lot, I'll give him my card and say, dude, send us that photo. We're going to get it in the magazine. You know, I mean, just keeping those connections going. And I think those things have gotten even easier now with, of course, all the electronic ways we can get things from people. But just having those connections is great. It's great. So keep it up. And, you know, like I said, I'm not going to just flip a switch. And I'll be keeping an eye on you guys. You hear about it if anything goes wrong.
Yeah.
Go ahead. We didn't
get to want all the pictures off your phone before you leave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We didn't get to talk about we didn't go there with pheasants, but that's a whole hour in itself. But I've got maybe some of you can call to help you with that.
I'm really happy that when we talk about our nesting programs, we say mallards and pheasant nesting. So, you know, it's an indicator species for our mallards.
So where's the best pheasant hunting at Colusa? Can you share with our listeners?
I got sad news. Colusa is in bad shape right now. The pheasant. You know, you don't want to go into
that. Yeah, we're going to be
there. But, you know, the Yolo Wildlife Area, I think everybody knows who chases pheasants. It's the new gold standard for public areas. And it's going to be another great year. It's all indications. Spot burner.
Yeah, yeah, wow.
What's that?
Spot burner. What are you doing?
No, dude, that train left the station a few years ago. I had nothing to do with it. It is crazy now.
You go. Over but if there. You have a comment on that, John's cell phone's number is 916. No.
No, it is 916-799-8869. It's on the website. Everybody should know it. I mean, you know, what can you do?
There you go.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.